Man, recording is here, so if it's not recording here, hopefully this machine doesn't fail. So, are there any questions or themes or explorations you may be curious about this morning that we go together? Yes, Cam?
I don't know if it's off topic.
There's no off topic, so just bring it.
I have many questions, but one that's pertinent for me sometimes is I suppose it's to do two kind of pronged. It's that one, so on clarity, and how does one actually ascertain whether they are entering into a greater state of clarity? Like, how does one actually ensure that or know that? And the other question is, how does one maintain or discover their kind of their like organic natural essence within a particular tradition or culture or group without feeling maybe like you're adopting or trying to fit in a certain way whilst also trying to respect and practice the kind of expectations kind of connect, if that makes sense. It's a bit jumbled, but
So there are two different questions, of course, always interrelated,
but related, because it's like, well, if I feel like if I had greater clarity in myself, I would be able to manage the second question better.
Thank you. Thank you. So yeah, I like to frame part of your question, at least in terms of the classical schism, so to say, between fitting in and belonging, right? Because many times I've observed we make those two ideas the same. Like yesterday we were talking, when we make loneliness and solitude one and the same, that becomes a problem, because generally when we make the same is the negative version, so to say, and not the positive one. And we lose sight that there is a positive way of being alone, so to say. So in the same way, sometimes I've seen practitioners across traditions, but mostly from our school, like making belonging and fitting in the same thing. Well, there are very different things, because in order to belong, you have to continue to be yourself. And only to, in order to fit in, you have to stop being yourself. So they are not similar ideas. They're exact opposites. But sometimes I've heard in how we use words, again, going back to yesterday's conversation of the words we use to indicate certain things and how those frame our experience, perception of reality. We may use fitting and belonging interchangeably. And that creates a big problem, because they are opposites, basically, right? So I will say that, going to your question on clarity and how to ascertain clarity, I think it has to do with the idea, with the second question. Again, one in two parts, in the sense that clarity has to do with belonging, not with fitting in. So for me, a sense of clarity, I speak for myself, will have to do with knowing that I already belong, in one sense, not trying to stop being who I am, compromising my integrity to be who I am. I'm already something, and that something, who I am, already belongs. In the words of, again, I like to quote Father Richard Rohr, he will say, everything belongs. So in one sense, I don't need to find something where I belong or to do something to belong. I already belong, but I'm not aware of that. Now, belonging in this sense, I'm talking what we were remembering, what we were saying yesterday in terms of non-dual thinking in our morning gathering here. there is a common center. We call it Krishna, but it's a common center with endless names. And everything belongs to that common center. Nothing exists outside a connection with that common center. So strictly speaking, everything belongs. Right? So a genuine spiritual path should teach that you already belong. And on that foundation, how you belong, how we all share a common center. And naturally, when we are open to that and we receive that type of revelation that confirms our deepest intuitions, hopefully, there will be a symptom. I mean, we'll say in Sanskrit, phalena parichyate. You judge a tree by its fruits. So clarity, gaining clarity, basically has to do with gaining a clear picture of what already is. No? Like who I am, everything belongs. And the moment you are exposed to those teachings, message, example, naturally clarity arises. No, I have a clear, we call in Sanskrit that to begin with, sattva. No, sattva. Sat means being, and tva is a Sanskrit prefix that could be translated in English and as ness, no, like playfulness, beingness. So sattva means beingness, no, like that state where you got a glimpse of what everything is, no, like clarity, basically. You start to perceive reality as it actually is, without that many filters, distorted filters, projections, and assumptions. And of course, in the beginning, we may carry lots of those. So I will say part of the process, spiritual process, is also to have the humility of knowing I may be coming here with a very loaded bag of assumptions and filters and prejudice and fears and which get in the way of my perceiving reality as it is, which gets in the way of clarity. So it may take time, it may be a process to gradually get rid of those filters and gradually gain a more and more accurate perception of what it is. No? And that's, of course, part of sadhana. Our practice is basically that. No? Mahaprabhu said, Cheta Darpana Marjanam, Sri Chaitanya. No? The very first immediate effect of the chanting of the name of Krishna is to clean the mirror of the mind from the dust. No? So we will make a parallel to the things we are talking about here. Those things that get in the way of clarity, basically. But at the same time, despite it's a process of gradual cleaning, we have that faith and that experience that if we are honest and sincere enough and we expose ourselves to a, let's say, higher source of knowledge and revelation, be it saintly teacher or person or revealed knowledge, reality itself, because God is omnipresent, we will have some type of epiphany, some type of clarity moment. No? You were telling me yesterday about some experience you had, right? And I share with you back, okay, I had similar experience, an experience that was clearly beyond our manufacturing, right? Like if I plan, okay, this evening I like to have this ecstatic revelation, this clarity moment, and things should be experienced. Like, even if you make all the plans and try to get there, those type of experience go way beyond our expectations and planning, and they are self-evident. So on one side, we should be honest and sincere in our inquiry. We should be clear about our intention. If we are talking about clarity, I think that's an important place to begin. Like, okay, I want clarity, but which is my intention first? I want clarity of intention first. From which place I'm approaching, in this case, Krishna, bhakti, this tradition, or any tradition for that matter, from which place, as much as I can be clear about it. It doesn't mean that I'm getting it absolutely right, but make an effort to be as clear with myself from which place I'm addressing, you know, people, relationships. And with that sincerity, naturally, I will be open to be impacted in a certain way that will purify me and help me to be even more sincere the next time, to gain more clarity. So I would say it's a gradual process of getting more and more and more and more and more clarity, like unveiling different like layers of reality. And a big part of that, again, has to do connecting to your second part of the question, fitting in and belonging. For me, at least personally, the confirmation in this direction of, okay, I want clarity, I want to relate to reality as it is. In one of our teachers, Srila Prabhupada, published Bhagavad Gita as it is. So I like to extend that application to everything as it is. Relationships as they are, me as I am, Krishna as he is, Radha as she is. I want to relate to everything as it is, right? So that's belonging. Belonging is me as I am. I want to show up as I am. I don't need to impress people. I don't need to fake perfection. I don't need to try to be more of what I am. Again, that has to do with clarity of intention, from which place I'm coming here today to you. I'm trying to impress you with some fancy philosophical concepts or some charisma, so you end up going back home thinking, oh, Swami Padmanabha was so advanced, so incredible, wow. Maybe I will give him some donation. or not, from which place? No, where's the integrity there? Or I'm just okay with being myself, no? Which is, as we were talking last night, it's not less. No? Who you actually are, again, as it is, the soul as it is, Krishna will say, Acharya. Again, amazing, wonderful. Is that not enough? So the fact that we sometimes make so much effort to show ourselves as something else or something more, it's a clear indication that we are not very much aware of who we actually are. Because when you really have a glimpse of who you are as a soul, for who you are, there is no need to fake it. No? In English, they have this saying, fake it till you make it. They use it here in New Zealand also. Yeah. Okay, it's very very useful in different places, cross-culturally. Fake it till you make it. I like to change the words a little bit and say naked till you make it. In the sense that there's no need to fake it. There's need to be naked, to be honest, to be sincere, transparent. And be like that till you make it, so to say. Like that's the method, not fake it, but transparency, honesty. And if in some particular spiritual group that's not being appreciated, well, run from that place as soon as you can. Right? If the coach of the group is like, in order for you to belong, you have to be like this thing, like that. Stop being who you are and be who we want you to be. That's a little bit like, right? Dangerous. At the same time, of course, we come with our baggage, again, of prejudices and filters and stuff that we are not, but identify with that, and a genuine spiritual group will help us to discern between who I actually am and all the bunch of stuff that is clouding my vision that sometimes I think I am. So also that part is there. It's not just that you come and there's over-validation and whatever you feel, think, and see, that's absolute and beautiful and perfect. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Let's be sober in that. But also not to the extreme of like everything about you is wrong. No? And you have to become something that is the exact opposite of who you are now in every sense of the term. That sounds like too much also. So my main point with this is like a real, at least for me, a real, not only spiritual group, but a real relationship. Any sensitive human relationship is one which starts with I accept you for who you are, where you are now. No? Because, I mean, that's the only possible thing we can do, actually. If I ask you, Father Kashyap, please, I accept you but only from a place that you are not and from a stage that you are not now. It's like, I cannot be there. I cannot.
It's actually rejection.
Yes, basically I'm saying I don't accept you. I accept you with this long list of conditions. But as we were talking yesterday, Krishna is accepting us unconditionally. So ideally, we should extend and reflect how God is accepting each of us. If we want to be accepted by Krishna unconditionally, the price to pay is, I mean, I'm already being accepted unconditionally, but in order to experience that unconditional acceptance, somehow I have to extend that to others. So unconditional acceptance means no matter how messy your life is, how confused you may be, how imperfect you may be, welcome. If you are honest and sincere, welcome. Because we are also imperfect and messy in our own ways. It's not only like we are all here pure and immaculate. Okay, you are messy and impure and imperfect, but we will welcome you. It's fine. It's not like that. We universalize the condition and bond together and acknowledging we are all imperfect and messy in one way or another, and we are all sharing this humanness in our spiritual journey, and let's belong. No, you don't need to stop being who you are. Actually, we value your honesty, your sincerity. No need to fit in. No. Again, fitting is impersonalism for me. It's again asking you be who you are not, and then we accept you, and then we love you, or and then Krishna loves you even worse sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, no. Become this ideal superhero template. Mm-hmm. And God will finally like you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not casting a good light on who Krishna is. We are not depicting a loving God. And I've seen sometimes practitioners having this like cognitive dissonance, because on one side it's like, okay, we will be loved and accepted until and unless you become perfect. But on another side, with the Krishna, hey Krishna, Karuna, Sindhu, he's an ocean of mercy and this, and it's like, short-circuiting. So yeah, I think we all need to find some shelter where we are accepted as for what we are. And paradoxically, as Carl Rogers would say, famous psychologist, he say, paradoxically, only when you accept yourself for who you are, only then you can change. So we are all about changing and improving, but the way to do that is first to accept who you are and where you are. That's basically Krishna's message in the Gita also, when he's saying, better you perform your duty imperfectly than someone else's duty perfectly. In other words, be who you are, whomever you can be, as imperfect as that is. That's way better than being the perfect version of someone else. That's like evasiveness, escapism. Yeah, there's one comment, and I think first verse of the third chapter of the Gita, Srila Prabhupada saying, when Arjuna was telling Krishna, I'm leaving the battlefield, I'm planning to become a monk and go on begging, and Krishna's like, you're not a monk, that's not your nature. Even if you leave the battlefield out of fear or out of concern or all the things that you are exposing, you have such a nature as a kshatriya that you will be brought by force to the battlefield. Your nature will bring you by force, but you will end up engaging in battle just being carried by force instead of willingly participating from the right place. But Arjuna was at that stage representing us again. It's not about Arjuna. Arjuna is Nitya Siddha. He has no issues. It's us. So Arjuna wants to run to not be himself, basically. And Prabhupada comments in the commentary, he's Krishna, Arjuna here is trying to use Krishna consciousness very skillfully to avoid engaging in battle. No. Like, he doesn't use the term spiritual bypassing, but basically that's what he's saying. Right? Here Arjuna is exhibiting spiritual bypassing, justifying his evasiveness and escapism, and trying to be someone he is not. So my point with this, sometimes we do that to ourselves, or sometimes we join a group that promotes that, and we end up buying into that. So ideally, neither of those things should be happening, right? So, and I think it begins, as Father Kashyap was saying yesterday, when referring to the second commandment, big important part, foundation to avoid all this is to have a strong sense of self-worth in a healthy way. Because if I don't have a proper sense of self-worth, being already loved and accepted by Krishna, I will be willing to do anything and everything to fit in. So someone validates me, loves me, cares for me, because I'm not doing that for myself on any level. So if someone does it on some level, I'm willing to prostitute myself emotionally, psychologically in so many ways, right? And for that's not the idea. But many times people join spiritual group from those places of big emptiness. And the spiritual people who are receiving that people, they should realize from which place each person is coming and help them gradually deal with their condition. Help them realize from which place they are coming. Because sometimes we are coming and we are not fully aware from which place we are coming. And we, so it's important that in time all those things become clarified. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, thank you.
Does it help?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll just quickly.
Not quickly necessarily, okay. Whatever. Yeah. Take your time.
What came up as then, like, how to navigate this kind of tension between being like authentic with where you're at in your being and your heart and your consciousness and your desires and your flaws as well, like how to deal with the tension and navigate this being where you are at present with all of your baggage and all of your conditioning, yet also kind of striving or working towards the ideals that are presented or expounded upon or you know, revealed to us. Because if you're just like, well, I just fully accept myself of where I'm at, and then I might be doing things that aren't really helping me grow or purify or clarify or become closer to the Lord or the Divine, Krishna. But if I'm leaning too much into I need to be like that, then I might be having the issue kind of talked about. Or, yeah, it feels like.
Yeah. He makes very good questions, huh? Thank you. So, a few short thoughts. And it's a very, again, valid question. I will say that it's a universal struggle, because how to navigate that tension is like an ongoing daily recalibration. It's not like, okay, I will say something, you get the answer, that's your formula for the rest of your life. No? That's not how it works. Reality operates in a more day-to-day presence and vigilance. No, like every day we should re-ask, okay, I'm leaning too much on the white extreme to the black extreme, or I'm keeping on the between gray in a balanced way, right? So for me, how it works, and again, trying to go to some personal testimonies, of course, because we can go too much to the side of, okay, Krishna loves me and I love myself and I accept myself, and it can become its own way of becoming stagnant or becoming complacent. No, like, I'm fully loved. That's it, guys. give me a break. And sometimes we may need a break. I can understand if you come from some chapters of your life where you experience the exact opposite of that for who knows how long, you may need just let me rest in this idea that I'm loved for a good time to heal. And there's total perfect place for that. Of course, at some point that starts to become like a plateau or some form of statu quo that we need to go beyond it, right? So I will say that if we are really aware, okay, Krishna, God is loving us unconditionally in our messiness, in our imperfection, we did nothing specific to deserve the absolute beautiful, infinite love of God, but it's there. If I really play out the implications of that, that should move me to tears. No? Like someone is loving me infinitely since day zero, for so to say, even when I was not even aware of that person, or I was even officially denying the existence of that person in some cases, still that person was just giving himself fully to me. as much as possible. In my moments of worst choices, God was recalibrating his own presence in my life to provide to me the best possible scenario for me to grow, to learn the lesson I needed. So if you play the implication of that, it should never lead to complacency. Like, oh yeah, so nice that Krishna loves me. Keep loving me. Thank you. But it should move you to a way that you start to ask you, how can I love? How can I give myself, my heart back to that? Not from a place of duty, fear, intimidation, but I would say from a place of celebration. No. Like Father Kashyap was saying yesterday, one of the best, and I've said that before, so I like that a lot also, one of the best ways to give ourselves in love to God is having that foundation that, oh, you're already fully loved by him. So you are loving him for the right reasons. No, many times I've seen practitioners, again, trying to love Krishna, but without knowing that he already loves you fully. So more from the place of, I have to love him. Because if I don't do that, he won't love me back. And that doesn't work. That's not healthy. So I will say that for me protects me from these two extremes. The extreme of complacency and I'm being loved and I don't want to love, but just to be loved. No, when you're aware of, again, how unconditional love operates, it should move to a place that we willingly want to reciprocate, give back. But also from a place of celebration, not from a place of, I have to love, I have to be perfect, I have to do it in a certain way. Because at the same time, the nature of love is that, how to say, it's always evolving. So you can always love Krishna more, and he can always love you more. So there's no final point that you have to attain. Following point, there's no, in one sense, there is no perfection in love. If we understand perfection as a fixed maximum, if we understand perfection, that this is perfection, does it mean that there's nothing else beyond that? Means I reach this level of love, I cannot love more, I cannot be loved more. That doesn't make sense. So it's an ongoing, ever expanding phenomenon. So in that sense, I can take rest from the idea of, okay, I'm here, point A, and I have to reach to point B at one point. I'm not yet there, so, and it starts to become like a, I have to reach there, that spiritual life, get into that B point, I'm not there yet. It's not so much that, because for us, it's, there is point B, Z, D, E, E, F, and continues to blossom infinitely. So instead of trying to be here and reach there, I'm going back here to where I am in the here and now and celebrate the chance I'm receiving here, knowing that there will be then a point B and a point Z and an infinite unfolding. So for me, that also relaxes from this tension of have to be there or do it in a certain way. And in the other direction, it protects us from the complacency of I'm just being loved, let me stay here. When we really witness the nature of the mercy of divine love is naturally inspiring, inviting to reciprocate, no? To engage in reciprocation. But I want to ask Father Kashyap a few thoughts on that as well. Yeah, please.
One thing that strikes me is that when we're talking about, so Swami had referenced the Rogerian way of receiving somebody, sometimes called unconditional positive regard. Mm. There's a major difference, though, between, let's say, an unconditional acceptance, which could implicitly foster complacency in the person being accepted, and the unconditional acceptance that promotes a vitality and a vigilance in the person to say, I love you exactly how you are, keep going. And become more of who you are. Don't just rest in who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think Swami made a good point. There are times and seasons in our lives of longer or shorter duration when we need to just rest. We cannot be in constant growth phase. Nothing that we see in organic life has that. Everything needs its resting and its rising. But it is time to rise sometimes, right? So after the rest, we have to be determined. Whether you call it as human persons growing or as sadhakas seeking, however it is that you want to term it, we are made to grow. as long as we honor the seasons in our lives of, again, I'll use the terms resting and rising. So if I can just end by saying this, there's unconditional love, but then there's unconditional love. And I know that I'm using the exact same words, but try to see the spirit behind the way that I'm saying them. That first kind of unconditional love is the kind of love that just lets the person be and lets them sink too. But the unconditional love that's full of vitality, and I'll even use the word passion, has the same amount of acceptance, either of another or of oneself, but also with the compassionate expectation that there's something more.
Thank you. Yeah, that really resonates. It's like both. It's like Krishna, the Lord, has that unconditional love and acceptance of where I'm at, but also knows who I truly am beneath all the conditioning and all the vice or the sin or the fallenness, and will hold me to that in unconditional love, attracting me back to Him all the way through, whilst always holding me in that unconditional love.
Perfect.
That connection, I was thinking, and I like to read a few short excerpts that was shared with me the other day from Father Richard Rohr, in connection to how, in the context of showing unconditional love, there is place to show conditional love, connects to what you are saying, as an expression of unconditional love, in connection to I want you to grow. And in that sense, I will like take a stance that seems to be demanding from you, but it's part of my unconditional love. So he says like this, brief, says, we need both unconditional and conditional love. if we are going to thrive. If we are lucky, we receive a combination of both kinds of love from our parents. Experiencing unconditional love as a child, giving us a strong base, a healthy, spacious sense of self. Yet, we need to hear this, the sacred no, something to bump up against, something that creates for us situations with limits, or we will never go deep and discover the best in ourselves. We need both a total acceptance and a conditional demand against our natural egocentricity. At its best, a father's love is also conditional because it teaches the son inner discipline, reasonable limits to his own ego, and an experience of his own power and skill in meeting the standards of his father. Without it, we develop the soft and self-accommodating entitlement that characterizes so many of us. Just a few extra thoughts that I feel are... And the emphasis, of course, on the importance of many times receiving that from our parents, ideally, and how sometimes when that's not there, that creates so much of the problems we see in adults, or adults, quote unquote. So
for me, that brings to mind the Uttam Adhikari and the Madhyam Adhikari. You have the Uttam Adhikari, he sees the unconditional vision. Everyone is engaged perfectly in devotional service. Everyone, except for me, everyone is perfectly engaged in emotional service becomes the under that Madhyam Adhikari platform. So he can discriminate and then help, then help those persons steps to actually achieve their full potential, achieve what he already sees and to come to that full potential. That's what that brought to light for me.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's important to make clear that unconditional love doesn't take one single form, right? Because sometimes we tend to idealize, okay, this unconditional love, and that takes us to, again, some form of stagnancy, complacency, entitlement. But it takes so many shapes, and sometimes the shape of it may seem the opposite to the other expression of it. But as long as there's the proper, the heart is in the right place, so to say, an unconditional heart is in the right place, it can take whatever form it needs to take. Even if it may seem like caressing, chastising, or this, if it comes from a heart of unconditional love, and we are honest and sincere in receiving that, we will feel the unconditional love coming through whatever packaging it's coming, no? And that's a long conversation, but I think that's a necessary one also in connection sometimes to leaders of, let's say, spiritual groups. And sometimes situations that are actually not coming from a heart of unconditional love are presented as such, as presented as tough love, but there is not actual unconditional acceptance, so it can be actually a situation of pastoral abuse. So that's another question. What's the difference between tough love and pastoral abuse? No? Mm-hmm. Externally, it may look the same. So in order to know what's actually taking place, you have to examine from where that's coming. So, because the result for the person in one case will be edifying and another traumatizing through the exact same act. No? So it's something that, yeah, in order to figure that out, we need to explore the invisible backdrop of it, not so much the form it takes externally, because sometimes we judge the external form, and because of that, we end up misjudging in one direction or the other. No? That's pastoral abuse. Maybe not. Maybe it's just genuine tough love. That's tough love. Maybe not. Maybe that's pastoral abuse. So we need to go with, no? The wellspring from where is it's that coming, right? Sorry, I didn't want to divert the conversation, but I felt it's all time. And these are important conversations to have. Yeah. Something else, whether in connection to this topic or any other topic, you may like to share, ask.
Swami, I actually have a question. It's quite basic. My guess is maybe anybody in the room could answer it. It's just a question on terminology for two areas.
Yes.
One has to do with the scriptures. The other has to do with lineage. And this is not a particularly deep question. I just need to get my terms straight. So when we speak of scripture, the two major designations I'm aware of are Shruti and Smriti.
Okay.
Shruti applies to the Vedas. Smriti applies to basically everything else of sacred text. Are both of those shastras?
Yes.
Okay, that's question number one. Question number two, what's the relationship sometimes like a Venn diagram where two things overlap between a guru parampara and a sampradaya?
Okay, that's a good question. Because sometimes, again, this may be conflated, is it?
Yeah, that's right.
But they are not necessarily the same thing. Yeah. So in a sampradaya, the word sampradaya, of course, these terms are difficult to translate, and sometimes you need to use 15 words, English words, to explain one Sanskrit word, right? And it's okay. Better you learn the Sanskrit and you use it and you know what you are talking about, but when explaining it, you cannot just say, I don't know, lineage. Yes, but a few more. So sampradaya, no? Sam means fully, and pradaya means like to give. So some of the meaning, the etymology of sampradaya is, again, lineage that fully gives a particular conception or perception of the absolute. No? By fully, we do not mean that's the only one, because it gives it fully. Everyone else is not giving it fully. That's the interesting thing. We speak about different sampradayas, implying that every sampradaya is giving fully a particular perspective to this absolute reality. So in brief, the answer will be paramparas are lineages of parampara means one after another, basically parampara of teachers and disciples. So there will be various paramparas inside one sampradaya.
Okay.
That will be the easiest way to
like
answer.
The family tree, like the tree refers to the sampradaya,
yeah,
and the individual branches where you can trace lineage, that's the parampara.
Yeah, that's okay. A way of saying it. Yeah. Okay. So in one sampradaya, let's say Gaudiya sampradaya, there are various paramparas, various lineages of succession, guru disciple succession. In Bharka sampradaya, again, all the sampradaya we've been talking about, Sri sampradaya, Madhva sampradaya, it's one sampradaya, but different paramparas. Sure. In the sampradaya.
Okay, thank you.
Is that clear?
Yeah.
Thank you. Sure.
I'm just trying to formulate the question properly. I was thinking about recently. I heard a podcast that you were interviewing a Christian speaker who was talking about new monasticism.
Okay, Adam Buco.
Yeah,
that was 2 years ago.
Was it Rory?
Rory McKenty.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Both of them are friends and they wrote together the book, The New Monasticism. Yeah, yeah. That's why I went to one, but there are two.
So you all have been. My question is related to something he said during that podcast, which I just remembered it. It was quite interesting for me. He said that in the beginning of our spiritual journey, we add meditation to our life. But then as we are progressing, we add our life into our meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, yeah, that's sort of interesting because we've been discussing this this type of silence and solitude
mm-hmm.
that we can access. And I was thinking about that in regard to my own japa meditation, this process of sort of getting to this silent sort of place of mystery you were describing, and how this mysterious place, how you add your life to a mysterious place.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So you want some elaboration
just
on that?
Just yeah, if any ideas.
Okay. So yeah, what comes to mind this moment is, as Rory was saying, okay, first you add meditation to your life and then you add your life to your meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of course, in the beginning, we may start our practice by making a difference between my life and my practice. Like my meditation, my practice, my life. And sometimes we have talked lingo, but in the Gaudiya Vaishnava community, sometimes you will hear this expression, okay, my spiritual life and my material life. And it is you who is making that division, basically. You choose to do it. There's no need to do it. As long as you want to do it, as you're keeping that dualistic separation inside of you, actually, in conceiving yourself as, I have like two lives, basically, some form of bipolarity. I have two identities, which again, in the beginning, it may happen. Srila Siddharth Maharaj, one of our teachers, he will say, one of the symptoms of the Kanishtha Adhikari, going back to Adhikaris, or the neophyte practitioner, in general, he will say that the person may go to the temple or to the church or to the whatever mosque and like, immediately I dress for the occasion, right? Okay, everything is placed and the behavior is all according to what's expected in the temple, and he knows what to do, how to raise the hand the proper direction, how to greet there. But when he crosses the door from the temple back home, he's not the same person. So still there is some like bi-identity complex there. And he's not condemning that. He's saying, okay, you have to begin somewhere. No, it's not that being a Kanishtha Adhikari is something bad. It's just not the goal. But you have to begin somewhere. No, for us to urinate ourselves now is embarrassing, but for a baby, that's okay. It's normal. You have to begin somewhere. No, that's not the goal of life. But it's healthy for you to do that at that stage. No, I cannot demand it. 3-month baby, like, stop doing that. Take responsibility for yourself. No, he will become dysfunctional. But again, if I over and show a toxic expression of unconditional love and encourage him to do that when he's a teenager, that's toxic in its own way. So my point with all this is that, yeah, in the beginning, we may be a little bit more separatistic and have this dualistic framework. Okay. Spiritual life, material life, and we want spiritual, and even if we are not talking about my material life and we only talk about my spiritual life, then we will do that in such a way that we are rejecting so many things as material life that they do not need to be rejected, actually. I've seen that also sometimes, whether you have spiritual life but also you have other things that you call material life, or whether you reject all those things, considering them material, but and I just do the spiritual thing. But many of those things could be part of your spiritual life also. But yet you are not yet able to integrate them. And it's okay. Okay, there is a time for that. So all this in the context of my practice, my life, my meditation, my life, eventually the two of them have to merge, right? Your sadhana becomes your life becomes your sadhana. There's no like clear division between the two. Gradually this melting, it's like a melting pot, no? Like sometimes sadhana or the sadhaka's life is compared to a melting pot, no? So gradually the whole thing is it's melting. It takes time, no? melting, alchemical process of melting, and everything becomes one in that sense. My life is my practice is my life. Thomas Merton will say, no, life of prayer, life of action. The two of them start to, my action is my prayer is my action. It's like, again, it has to happen naturally. It's a process. But as Father was saying yesterday, also quoting the Bible, pray unceasingly. No? We also have so many lives of that. The third verse of Shikshastakam Mahaprabhu says, Kirtaniya Sada Hari. Sada means always. Krishna the Gita says, Satatam Kirtayantamam. Satatam means always, uninterruptedly. No? And again, if you take it literally, I should not stop chanting, doing kirtan. I cannot do anything but. No, it's not that. It's as we say yesterday, someone who prays becomes prayer. So when you become prayer, even if you are taking a shower or peeling potatoes, you have become prayer. So whatever comes from you, it comes from that spirit. Of course, that's a mature fruit to attain. In the beginning, still there may be my practice, my life, but gradually the two of them become one. No? In one sense, even you don't have a public life and a private life. No? Sometimes it's one thing. It's the same thing, right? What do you think?
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. What do you think, Raturup? Any thoughts on that?
I have to think. I'm a little distracted.
It's okay.
Some business matter.
No problem. Your material life. Yeah, I remember once I was in Argentina in this connection talking with a friend, and we were trying to make this point. And he said, but Swami, I'm married, I have a family, so I have to work. And that has nothing to do with spirituality, you know, from that place. And I asked, like, well, but why you are working? I asked him, why you are working? I asked from that place, like, why to work? Why you are working? And he was like, because to earn money. Why you need money? Well, to maintain my family. And then I asked him, and why to maintain your family? So he was like, oh. I never asked that question. So my point was like, you can do that as a service to God. You can relate to them as part of your spiritual life. No. If you are not establishing that link, of course, all that sequence, working, money, family, remains mundane, material, and you keep that dualistic thing. But when you are able to tie that all back to Krishna also, then having a family, being a father, being a husband, working, earning money, can all be also become part of your practice. But we have to be expert in establishing sambandha, that proper connection. No? Sambandha means proper connection and relationship of everything back to its source. So not to over-justify things and like, oh, it's all for Krishna, I'll serve, because sometimes that can be abuse also. I've seen that. Yukta Vairagya. Yukta Vairagya, we have this notion, Yukta Vairagya. No, Rupa Goswami says, Anashaktasya Visayam Yatartham Upayunjata Nirbandha Krishna Sambandhi Yuktam Vairagya Muchyate. Proper renunciation means to use everything in relation to Krishna. And improper renunciation means to renounce things without having established their connection with Krishna. Sorry?
That last part I didn't quite catch.
Yeah. Improper renunciation, that's the next verse. He speaks about falgu vairagya, or like false renunciation. It means to reject things. No, like if they have no connection with Krishna. Oh, this is bad. This is material.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of saying, no, actually it has a connection to Krishna. I can use that from that place. But rejecting it superficially without actually tying it back to its source, that's false renunciation. So real renunciation is, I don't need actually to reject anything. I just need to accept everything in connection to God. Of course, that's easier said than done. That's why I say sometimes the idea is abused and you end up indulging in things in a selfish, exploitative way, but you are framing that like, Yukta Vairagya, this is just, everything's connected to Krishna. Yes, but we have to have the capacity to establish that connection inside of us. So we have to be sincere about how much we can engage in that. And again, going back to sincerity, right? Because, yeah.
Guru Nanak would say that if you can't love your family, then how can you love Krishna?
That's great.
Again, you have to see your family. Everything is connected to Krishna. Krishna loves everybody. If you can't love your family, then how can you love Krishna? Prabhupada gave that example of the mother with, she sees a little baby shoe, little baby boot. Immediately she sees that, she thinks of her baby, and some affection comes into her heart. So we should be like that. Whatever we're seeing, we think Krishna loves everybody, everything. So we should connect everything with Krishna. So naturally, some affection will come into our heart for every living entity, for every person. And then once connected like that, then we can progress and make progress in our actions in spiritual life.
Yeah.
We can start to begin to love Krishna. Otherwise, we think everything is separate. Then.
And we should only love Krishna. And I end up, quote unquote, loving Krishna and hating everything else. And what love is that for Krishna? Poor Krishna, what I'm giving him.
Krishna is your best friend, but I'm ignoring you and I'm treating you poorly. Then what will Krishna think?
Yeah. Like we were quoting yesterday this intense quote from, what's her name? I forgot her name now. This Christian contemporary.
No, it's a Christian mystic.
Yeah, I forgot her name now. Dorothy Day.
Yes.
No? I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least.
No?
It's basically what you are saying. My love for Krishna has to be reflected in all my relationships. So that's a good like thermometer, you say? Yeah. Thermometer, like yardstick to see, okay, where I am.
It's a very humbling thing.
Yes, but realistic.
Mm.
Realistic. It may be confronting because sometimes I may realize, well, it seems I don't love Krishna that much because I'm not treating very well my wife or my friends or my brother. Not to chastise myself and go into depression mode, but just to also not cheat myself. I don't want to cheat myself in the name of loving Krishna.
I have a question on that
yes.
point. Father Keshen, he brought up the kind of saying of hate the sin, not the sinner.
No, he even said, hate the sin, love the sinner.
Hate the sin, love the sinner.
That for me was like an upgraded version of the whole thing. Yeah.
What does, how does that actually feel and look like in practice, in an actual interaction with, say, someone you're meeting and you find your false ego, your mind judging, they might be in, you know, how does that actually feel and look and be?
Okay. He will be the ideal person to answer, but I know he went to Balaram to prepare prasad, so that's a very crucial engagement. We don't want them to be somewhere else. So they are in the right place. So what I will just respond to that from my limited experience is, and I, again, I'm not saying that in the way of I'm perfect example of that, but for me, many times, let's say you are in a particular situation and someone is being sinful, if you are using the example of hate the sin, not the sinner, love the sinner, sinful in the sense of maybe mistreating you or mistreating others or being, I don't know, extremely arrogant. Some of the things that are like, and we're not free from those, just in case, probably. So instead of just limiting that person, and we may need to take some distance to love the sinner, right? Because if we are just there and receiving the impact of their whatever wrath or judgment, it may be difficult for us to, okay, I'm loving the sinner, right? It may be even superficial, like forcing myself, I have to love the sinner, I have to love the sinner. So we may need some healthy distance to look back at the person and see that that behind the so-called sin or behind the so-called fault, there is a fragile, broken human being in need of love, in need of grace, in need of shelter, and all that wrath or whatever sin they are expressing is just a symptom of their confusion and brokenness and sadness and neediness. Now, many times when someone is very angry, behind that there is neediness. The person is in certain needs that are not being satisfied for them. They're expressing that from that place. So you can see someone in need instead of someone angry. Again, it chooses how we frame, it all depends how we frame that in our own, how we label the situation. If I say angry, bad, demon, whatever, bad person instead of in need.
How deep are we seeing?
Exactly. How much we go beyond the symptom of the anger. In one sense, the anger is like a superficial symptom that speaks about something way deeper that you have to go to the root. So, and to go there again, sometimes we may need to take a distance, because if we are too close to the symptom, we can get just trapped there, and it's understandable. So I take a distance in order that I can see you for who you are. I'm not taking a distance being indifferent or escaping, but just to commit myself to appreciate the situation with more accurate vision, right? Not to run away from the situation. It may seem I'm running away, but actually I'm doing that to gain a more clear perspective, because if I'm too close, I'm become too much enmeshed in the whole thing. I sometimes give the example of the hand. Sorry. If I put my hand here, it's too close to my eye. I lost sight of it. In order to see the hand for what it is, I need some distance. Okay, now I can understand it. But if it's too much on me, I lose my objective perception of that. So, and that works for so many other symptoms. I don't know, someone is arrogant. And sometimes in our tradition, we may hear strong words about arrogance, and that's something unbecoming, and it is, of course, we are not promoting that. But also we should be careful how we deal with something like arrogance when it comes from someone else or ourselves, because we may be quick to label, quick to judge, quick to condemn, quick to stigmatize, and not be compassionate. For me, the yardstick is you have to remain compassionate when you are dealing with all of these things. How much you can deal with that with compassion and not with judgment, resentfulness, hatred, indifference, but compassionate presence. So if someone is arrogant, you may feel, oh, that guy who he thinks he is, he tries to. Or you can think, oh, that person probably has a very poor self-image that he needs to constantly augment who he is in front of others, trying to impress, trying to take their attention, because he has not a wholesome self-image that is enough for him, right? Because that's the background of arrogance, actually. So when you connect with that layer, you can be compassionate and you can understand, you know, that person, and instead of just getting stuck in this arrogant, bad, whatever, no, broken, poor, fragmented, fragile, low self-worth. And trying to be arrogant, trying to make up for that, and not letting others see his own brokenness, and not even letting himself see his own brokenness. So these are different ways for me that in which we can like deal with other people's love the sinner, going back to the original quote, how to love the sinner and hate the sin. Hate the sin doesn't mean hate the sin, but just separating the act from the person and seeing the person beyond the act, so to say, and from which place the person is actually acting. No? And as Father was saying yesterday, and I'm going to your raised hand in a minute, but sorry. He was saying that, and we also agree with that, that when if you want to use the word evil, like evil acts, evil people, we don't agree that that's an ontological condition. It's not that they're evil souls, that their own makeup is evil. We will use the word avidya, basically, which avidya means ignorance, or avidya, lack of knowledge. Like Father was giving the example of light and darkness. Now, darkness is an absence of light. In one sense, it has not a reality unto itself. So in that way, we do not over-judge people by the act, you are evil, you are... Or ourselves, again, I've seen many times practitioners, they over-identify themselves with their shortcomings. I'm so envious, and I'm so arrogant, and I am that. And you kind of like become that in your own estimation, and that makes it all the way more difficult to to distance yourself from that and have a more objective perspective. No, I'm not that, actually. But that's there somehow getting in between, but that's not me. And be more self-compassionate in that sense also, right? Padre, sorry, you were raising your hand an hour ago.
every minute almost, you say something which sparks something.
Yeah, yeah, I saw you, you were like...
That when you were talking about not being able to see clear because we're too involved in something, I just thought of the idiom, you can't see the forest for the trees. And when we get outside the forest, then we can see the trees.
Yes.
I just thought of that to sort of clarify what you're saying.
Yeah.
That was one thing. And another thing is that as far as I have perceived, and I'm not sure if it was clarified in scripture, this is a question, that pride and fear actually come from the same place, which is what you were talking about. We need to arrogance and you know, putting ourselves forward is actually a compensation for feeling fearful, actually, and underconfident.
Yeah.
And so that those two things, those two psychological phenomena, pride and fear, come from the same place. That's my sense. And I just, if you could comment on that and make it, is it there any reference in it? And there's just one more thing.
Okay.
About someone who, this is my own experience. If I can't love somebody, if somebody has just, it's just too distasteful for me to find love for them, I found it progressive to just at least not think any bad thought about them. If you can just at least be neutral and not have any criticism or bad thought, then that's the beginning of of love.
thank you it makes total sense. You kind of just force yourself to love everyone unconditionally in the brightest way, right? It's also because if you push yourself too much, you are not being loving to yourself. So unconditional love has to be unconditionally loving in every direction. So if I love you unconditionally, it has to be in a way that I'm also loving myself unconditionally. If in the name of loving you unconditionally, I'm just chastising myself or betraying myself, or that's not so loving, no? So,
Just thinking that sometimes a very central figure in a temple community, you know, can be a person who's you're struggling to love for all sorts of reasons, and it's like, you know, to separate off can be quite difficult because you could be so enmeshed in it yourself, but yet you've got to try and establish some distance, and you don't always know that distance can be achieved because you could turn up at the temple and that person's significant person's there, and it sometimes it can be like, you know, how do I negotiate all this?
Yeah, yeah, I know there can be complex scenarios and there may not be easy answers. Just like, do this, press this button, and it's all like working in harmony.
Yeah.
So we may navigate all those dynamics and find the proper way, but and sometimes, yeah, as you say, Bhadra, sometimes the first thing is a healthy distance of sorts. Like Rupa Goswami will say, no, we love Krishna, we are friends with the devotees, we are compassionate with the innocent souls, and we may need to be distant from the envious people.
Mm.
Again, not to judge them and say they are such poisonous black snakes that they deserve to burn eternally. Not that. Just like, it may be too much to be close to that person. And maybe if the person is envious, and again, behind envy, there are so many other things, right? Because envy generally means, is, or a Acharya will say, is your incapacity to tolerate other people's success, right? But again, behind that, there can be, again, a broken person that whenever you have some good quality, I feel threatened. Because I see nothing good about myself. So that sometimes translates into envy in some cases. But behind the, again, for me, the healthy question is always what's behind the envy, the arrogance, the wrath. And you can always reach back to a point of fear, brokenness, need, where you can express compassion in a more substantial way. So regarding your question whether this is explained in Shastra, probably it may not be necessarily articulated as we are doing it now, which is not the fault of Shastra at all. It's just, it's there, as I will point to one verse now, in certain way. And the articulation we are having now is an extension of our making sense of scripture, so to say, and that's natural exercise. Shastra Yukti, we call that also. And again, I will go to this foundational verse for me from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, which starts with the line, and I will just stop in that first line, Bhayam Dvitiya Abhinivesitasya. Of course, the verse continues, but the first line is saying, when we are absorbed in duality, again, dualistic thinking, fear arises. And it stops there in one sense. Of course, the verse continues, but my point is, and from that fear, I will add, by what we are talking about, all these other things come. No? Wrath, envy, this. I mean, we can all trace this anarthas, trace back to some form of fear. And of course, we can trace fear back to some form of dualistic thinking, which comes because of avidya. No? If you want to do the whole sequence, it's avidya, ignorance, lack of knowledge of who I am, who Krishna is, what everything is, lack of proper vision and education, then that leads to dvitiya, dualistic thinking, seeing things separate, me isolated from everyone else, and that begets fear, because I'm alone. I'm in this world by myself, alone, disconnected, without shelter, without center. If I have that vision, you are against me, I'm against you, all these type of dualistic patterns create fear. And in order to cope with fear, we end up living life in certain ways that the symptoms of that lifestyle end up being envy, wrath, this, that, which are all anarthas, of course. We sometimes initiate this anarthas, kama, krodha, lobha, mada, moha, matsarya, not like lust, wrath, greed. And it's fine, but it's for me important to not get, to not over, let's say, judge people, just you have lust, you have wrath, you have greed, or I have all that stuff. So I have to do, I have to transcend that. Yes, but part of the transcendence is understand them, from where this is coming. I'm going beyond the lust, so to say, beyond the greed, beyond, and by beyond, I'm not saying going to Golok Vrindavan up, but I'm saying going down, going to the root behind last breath, and probably you will always find some form of fear, need. No? You will contact that more broken, fragile person in us, in others, so we can be reach that point of compassion, no, and understanding of the situation, and deal with that without the need of stigmatizing and condemning and demonizing others or ourselves. Because when we do that, we are augmenting the problem. So for me, that line, that verse of the Bhagavatam is giving the beginning of that sequence, and it's expecting from us that we play out the rest of the sequence ourselves, so to say, right? I don't know if that makes sense. Sorry again?
Bhaya and abinivesh. What is the verse?
Bhayam dutiya abinivesh tasyat. Bhayam means fear, abinivesh means absorption, dutiya means duality. So by absorption in duality, fear comes. No.
Isn't that one of the big questions, is what initiated that original avidya, that original dual? That's one of the big questions in that people explore and have different answers for.
Yeah, even in our tradition, there are different answers. Mm-hmm. Or there are even different opinions, I will say, about that, how it all began. Right? I can give my answer, which is, of course, I try not to make it, to say it's my answer, but try to make it as based as I can on Shastra. And I know it may be not an answer easy to digest or easy to fully understand with our head, but the answer is there's no beginning. Because our question is how it all began. It never began. It's without beginning. The Sanskrit term is anadi. Anadi avidya. Anadi means without adi, without beginning. The logic here is we are eternal. Material energy is eternal. Therefore, the connection between material energy and the soul has no beginning either. For of course, it can have an end, and that gives hope.
So on that level of vision, don't beat yourself up, or you take it too seriously on that very elevated level of vision of like...
I didn't understand, sorry.
On that level of like that it's eternal,
mm-hmm.
beginning with,
mm-hmm.
from that level of vision,
yeah.
or understanding or awareness, you don't have to beat yourself up too much or take it too seriously. Like, take it seriously, but you don't have to be like...
You are inherently a cult.
Yeah, like just really cave in and like a victim's kind of state of like, how did I fall? How did I? Why did I fall? Why did I fall from?
From whatever.
From whatever.
Yeah, there are other versions which in some groups go their circles. There may be different opinions. And again, I'm not here trying to enter in debate. You think like that, I will debunk your argument right now. I'm not that one. But some will think, yeah, you were with Krishna in the spiritual world and you fell from there. Some others may say you were in Brahman, you fell from there. And some others will say you didn't fell from anywhere, but you have been in that loop since time without beginning. I will say whatever, despite I think what I share is what the Shastra teaches, the gist of whatever version you pick in one level is take responsibility for your own choices. Not to the point of starting a weeping festival, because that's self-indulgence in its own way, but also, yeah, take responsibility. You didn't, if one subscribes to what I'm sharing, okay, you didn't fell from anyone at one point in time, but we could say, but still you keep choosing. Again, not to enter into a shame trip, but just to take responsibility in the sense of whenever I decide to love Krishna, okay, that will happen, but I have to choose that myself. Krishna already loves me, but he won't, as Father Kashyap was saying yesterday, he's a humble lover, so he won't impose himself like, you have to love me also. No, and he won't decide for us. Love has to be voluntary. If it's just forced, it's not love. No, if I put you a gun and say, love me, probably you'll say, yes, I love you, so I don't kill yourself. But you're not loving me. It has to be just like voluntary choice. So yeah, we have great capacity not to choose love, let's put it that way, for a long time. But again, not to enter into any guilt shame trip toxically, just to take responsibility, not to play the victim, not to over lash ourselves, just take responsibility. Whenever you want to love Krishna and establish a relationship with him of love, voluntary, he's more than ready for that. He has been loving you since eternity. So, but yeah, we have to be expert not to make any of these things like a toxic guilt trip, because it's so easy. It's so easy.
I'm not sure if it, my memory is not the greatest, if it was you, but I recall someone saying that there was one view on the material world as being an overflowing of the Lord's bliss and expansional variety.
It's possible. I mean, I don't want to say it was me, but I say that all the time. So
yes, like
I mean, I'm not saying all that all the time. I'm quoting Shastra to show that that's being said in the scripture.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, it could have been someone else.
Our
stances, Vedanta Sutra say Lokabhattu Lila Kaivalya. The Srishti Lila, or the whole cosmic manifestation, is Lila of God. It's a play of God. And play, and the commentaries on that sutra says, like, the whole cosmic creation comes like an outpouring of God's own bliss. No? So we don't need to see the world of matter as bad. There are things, bad things we do in relation to the world. But material energy in itself is an energy that is serving Bhagavan. So nothing to, yes. Yeah.
So. Are you on sale?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have a little excerpt of that, a little book that I can give you. It's just an excerpt of that 16th chapter, which explains a little bit, gives a bit of an introduction to that whole. Well, this is all Krishna's little, always serving Krishna. No one can avoid serving Krishna.
And that's the Uttama's vision right there, is seen from that. Mm-hmm.
And Bhagavatam said the highest devotees is Krishna is in everything and everything is in Krishna. There is nothing to reject, nothing to condemn. The only thing we need to reject is the type of vision that do not show things like that. No, what's getting in the way of that vision, that we need to. And it's not even about rejecting something, but actually accepting the real thing, no? Because also that's important that we do not orient our practice in negative terms.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do in your practice? I do not do this. We do not do that. But what you do, you do. Do you do something? No, we just reject stuff. Yeah. I like to give that example because sometimes many devotees, kind of the first thing they say in some groups to define their practice or identity. I can imagine. I won't ask you about that. It's fine. We talked that out of camera. But sometimes, okay, so what are you about, guys? What are you doing? We don't eat meat. We don't intoxicate. We don't have illicit sex and we don't gamble. Okay, well, you just told me what you don't do. And actually, even those four regulative principles, as they are sometimes called, are not about not doing things, but they have their positive value, no, like not eating meat. No, the principle is not don't eat meat. The principle, in one sense, is be ahimsa, non-violence. Even if I say non-violence, still is negative, right? I'm not violent. What's the positive side of being non-violent? What you will say? Be compassionate, be kind, loving, right? So, and even the principle, I wouldn't say the principle is actually about being loving, kind, compassionate. It's be as loving and as compassionate as you can. It's not just, okay, I will be loving and compassionate just a little bit. I'm following the principle. No, try to be as much as you can, as loving as compassionate. That's the principle. That's very different from do not eat meat. Do not eat meat, be as loving, as compassionate as you can. That's the real principle. And that's positive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not doing something. It's doing something as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
No? And the same with all the other principles. It's not don't go to the casino in Nelson. It means, just in case, I'm saying. I saw a few of you last night roaming around. We're making some plans. You came too late last night. It's about being truthful, right? The principle is satyam. Be truthful. Of course, going to the casino may be an example of what gets in the way to that, but that's not the whole thing. We shouldn't be reductionistic. It's about be as truthful as you can. And probably if you play out that, you will realize I'm breaking all the four regulative principles. I'm not being as truthful as I can. I'm not being as loving. Not again, not to enter into a guilt trip, but just not to think I'm already doing that. Because that's the danger. Oh, I already followed those four regs for time immemorial. Like probably you haven't started yet doing that properly. So we have to keep that humble balance, if not taking it for granted that I'm already doing that. But of course, also not weeping ourselves because we are not doing that fully. So try to navigate some in between balance, right?
Krishna's compassionate and loving. Like you're saying about the child, you know, you don't throw the child because it's urinating. You know? This is the child will urinate. The child will. You have to change the child. That's the nature of the child. So we're like that. We're like children. And Krishna's like, you know, I'm sorry. He has compassionate and love for us. He understands what our situation is. He loves us and he will help us. It's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He's extending his hand. And he has taken us by the hand. His compassion and love has taken us by the hand. So without considering any offense,
yeah,
any sinful activity we may perform, Mahaprabhu is just full of compassion and love. That's why we chant his name before we chant the Hare Krishna Mantra. We chant Mahaprabhu's name, Nityananda's name. He will take us by the hand. He will take us to Vrindavan. He will take us there. Because he has that compassion. No one else.
Yeah.
Who can help us in this age? We're so fallen. No bodily, nothing. But Mahaprabhu, he has unconditional, unlimited mercy. And he can reach out and he'll take us by the hand. So we have nothing to fear.
It reminds me when you mentioned the urinating baby example. Mahaprabhu himself is saying that once. If I'm not mistaken, it's when Sanatan Goswami is having some like open source and Sri Chaitanya is cleaning those and embracing him. And Sanatan Goswami feels like so bad, like, please do not touch me. I'm so polluted, so sick. You are so high. And Mahaprabhu keeps... The more Sanatan Goswami says that, the more Mahaprabhu embraces him and cleans that. And he gives that example, if I'm not mistaken, in that moment. And if not, it's another conversation, which is the same. He gives the example when a mother is, when the baby is like, I don't know if it's urinating or passing a stool, and the mother is cleaning that. And with the big smile, it's not that for the mother, it's like, how embarrassing I have to engage in this, how horrible. The more she does that, the more her love for the baby increases. No? So the same way Mahaprabhu will say, I'm just increasing my love for you, basically. No? There's no problem here. No? So inviting to allow ourselves to be cleansed and embraced, in, even if we are still a living mess, as they have this quote, at least that I saw once in one kitchen in the US. I entered into a kitchen and there was a sign saying, God bless this mess. And the kitchen was a mess, by the way. But I took that not for the kitchen. I applied that to me. God bless this mess. And he blessed the mess. No, he's loving us unconditionally.
So. We apply our intelligence and our minds to what's actually happening. What Mahaprabhu was doing, where we are, what Mahaprabhu was doing, we were just... It will amaze us. That's true.
Yeah.
We don't realize it fully. But even at this point, it's amazing.
Yeah.
We actually realize it.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here now saying all the things if it wouldn't be for that mercy, right? This conversation wouldn't be happening. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai. Something else? If not, we can put the conversation to rest. Never to sleep, to rest for a while only. It's always ongoing conversation. So, yeah, maybe we can I mean, we can continue sharing more informally, but we can put the conversation, this one, this conversation to rest for a moment. So, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpataru Vishcha, Gripasandhu Pyai Vacha, Patitanam Pavanepyo Vaishnavepyo Namo, Anantakoti Vaishnavrinda ki jai, Gaur Hari Bol.